I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Happy holiday on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day of Service. Conversations with three community activists for whom service is a daily endeavor. J.C. Falk is the founder of Be More Community Food, which rescues good food that might otherwise be thrown away and delivers it to people in at-risk communities. Dr. Maricela Gomez is the founder of Volar, the Village of Love and Resistance, a grassroots community development organization that empowers Black and brown people to own property in East Baltimore. Bishop Bruce Lewandowski is a member of BUILD and the pastor of the Sacred Heart Church in Highlandtown. He serves a Latinx community who suffer from the physical and financial effects of COVID-19 without access to government assistance. Plus, remembering the violence interrupter, Dante Barksdale. First, the news. And good afternoon. Happy holiday. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall on this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday and day of service. Today on our program, we will meet three people for whom every day is a day of service. A little later, I'll speak to Dr. Maricela Gomez, who's working to bring land and property ownership to marginalized communities in East Baltimore, and Bishop Bruce Lewandowski, who is working with the Latinx community in his Highlandtown neighborhood. But first, we turn to J.C. Falk, a diversity and inclusion consultant who is an OSI fellow and the founder of Be More Community Food. He helps underserved communities weather the storm of COVID-19 by giving healthy food to families on the West Side and across the city. J.C. Falk joins us on Zoom. Hey, J.C., good to talk to you.
Hello, Tom. Good to talk with you again.
Give us a sense of how much food you are distributing to families across the city.
Somewhere the last 4 months, we did just below 400,000 pounds of food, so close to 100,000 pounds of food per month. And we expect to do somewhere between 1.2 and 1.5 million pounds of food this upcoming year.
That's a lot of food. And where does the food come from? Where do you get it?
Comes from a ton of different spots. We get some from Amazon. We get some from a place called First Fruits Farm in Pennsylvania, Mozi Bread, Gotham Greens, Guinness Bread. We have a bunch of places that we get food from.
And you're involved in what's known as the food rescue movement. I mean, this is food that is being made available to you by these farms and by huge companies like Amazon. This is food that would normally, I guess, go to Whole Foods for sale. But why is it that you have access to it? How can Amazon give you this food?
Well, there's a combination of things. One, there's some real simple things that happen in the process of food. So somewhere between 30 and 40% of the food that's harvested in America is thrown away every year. Now, most of us think about that food like wilted leaves, you know, like it's on its last breath. And really it's not. A lot of the food that's in that 30 to 40% bracket is very usable. Like we get food, we get water. I mean, you know, bottled water and San Pellegrinos and rice and canned goods. We get all kinds of stuff. In the process of stuff, I've noticed this over the time that I've been doing this, and I wasn't a food guy until COVID, that most of the places that produce this food, they have food coming in and out all the time. And a lot of time what they have is a dock problem. They have a dock problem where they can't store the food, so they have to get it out. They either have to give it out to somebody like me, or they got to throw it in the can. So I find places that are like who need to get rid of what they consider to be trash, right? And it's not really trash, you know, but they consider it to be trash. And I'm basically finding more and more places where I can stand between them and the trash can before that that good food hits it.
Yeah, that's amazing. So if you didn't pick it up a couple of times a week, they would have to throw it away to make room for the next truck of food that's coming in on their loading dock. Is that how this works?
That's absolutely how it works. So they either find someone else other than me to come pick it up, or they'll call me to come pick it up, or it'll get dumped into the trash can. You know, there's a few of us that go over there to pick up the stuff, and it's an amazing amount of food. But when you think about Amazon is a massive organization, and so their food that they consider to be throwaway food for me is like I feel like Fred Sanford or something. You know, I go over there and I like get up all of the good stuff and I pass it out to my neighbors. You know, and and so that's that. So for them, what's trash is a good meal for people. And it's not, like I said, it's not brown chicken. It's not wilted leaves. It's very good food.
If you just joined us, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is J.C. Falk. He is the founder of Be More Community Food. If you have a question for J.C. Falk, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday at wypr.org. You can tweet us as well, at Midday WYPR. So, J.C., when you pick up this food, you rescue it literally. How do you package it? How do you get it to folks who need it? What's the logistics of what you need to do with this, you know, these hundreds of thousands of pounds of food every month?
I tell you, the process for us has been one that's changing always. We started, the very few people who had food experience before COVID-19 on my team right now. There's one person who has had significant food experience. We have 3 employees right now, and we have 183 people the last time I checked on the volunteer list. So we're never short of volunteers. And so basically we wouldn't be able to do what we do without our volunteers. It would not be possible for us to get out 100,000 pounds of food to 3 of us. And so we basically what we do is we get fresh food from different organizations, perishable and non-perishable. We make these boxes that are 20 pounds and we give those boxes away. Plus we give 2.5 to 5 pounds of meat on top of that box, so they can get 22 to 25 pounds per box. If the family is larger, they get more food. So for every 3 people, they get 1 box. If you have 9 people in your family, you get 3 boxes and 3 portions of meat. We have a kind of a manual, it's a pseudo manual system set up inside where we can create the box. We had a tape machine in there to tape the top and the box, top and the bottom of the boxes. And we produce somewhere around 120 boxes per hour with this crew that we have in shop right now. We make these boxes, we take them out to the community and give them away. Not only do we take them out to the community in large bulk to give them away, our delivery process, last week we delivered 177 of those food kits to people. No charge to them for the food and no charge for the delivery. So if you're immune deficient or you're senior or you have something going on with you that you can't get to where we are, we have a limited amount of space where we can actually deliver. And last week it was 177 deliveries, and we're bouncing it up to 200 this week. And we're hoping to increase it more and more as we go, depending upon what kind of resources we have.
Yeah, 200 deliveries is amazing. And 183 volunteers is also quite extraordinary. Where are you located? Is that, and that's one of the places that people can come and pick up these boxes of food. But you also have several other places scattered around the city where people can get food as well. Give us a sense of where folks can go.
So a couple of the primary place is our location at 300 West 24th Street. It's near North Howard and 24th Street. At that location, so last Saturday, we went from 3 to 5 p.m. Every week it's 3 to 5 p.m. that we have a curbside giveaway, and we probably gave away 5,000 pounds of food on that day. And every week we do the same thing. And so at our location, we have that curbside. I do a curbside at Greenmount West on Tuesday. So tomorrow at about 4 o'clock, we'll be in Greenmount West. There'll be a line there when we get there of 100 people before we even show up, and they start lining up. Tom, the giveaway is at 4 o'clock. People start lining up at 1 o'clock. Even recently, when it's chilly outside, they start lining up at 1 o'clock, or they'll bring chairs and lay them out. People need food right now, and they need it in a big way. You know, I read an article not long ago where the Maryland Food Bank estimated that there were about 125,000 people, about a quarter of the city, was having some kind of food insecurity thing going on before COVID showed up. Now they estimate that about half of the city, 300,000 people, have some kind of food insecurity going on. And no matter what we give, like 100,000 pounds of food, 200,000 pounds of food, it's scraping it's like the tip of the iceberg on some levels. You know, and when you think about the level of food insecurity here in Baltimore and elsewhere in our country.
And you are focusing on getting the food in particular to neighborhoods that have what we call food deserts. In other words, it'd be difficult, even if they had the financial resources, it'd be difficult to get to a grocery store to get the amount of food that you're making available to them either to pick up or to deliver.
Absolutely. We have neighborhoods where over in the Oliver neighborhood about 2 months ago, they shut down the last grocery store in that neighborhood. It was a Save-A-Lot. And about 2 weeks after that Save-A-Lot shut down, we took 6 pallets of food over to that same Save-A-Lot parking lot and dropped them for people. And the line there was 150 people. And so we try to target places where, you know, either low income communities, low income and Black communities is part of it. And then immigrant communities also, we're targeting immigrant communities. Somebody said something a little earlier about how immigrant communities are being hammered by this thing right now because they're afraid to go forward. It's like this country is, it's an oppressive nation that we live in on many levels, you know, around a person's immigration status, around race, around their sexual orientation. There's so much oppression going on in this culture that people don't go to see the doctor when they need to go see the doctor. And a lot of people don't feel like they can go and ask for food when they need food because they're going to be a target if they get there. So what we do, like with the immigrant communities, we have a registration process for our site that we do on site. The other giveaways, we don't have a registration process, particularly for that reason, because we want people to be able to eat because they're hungry and not have to jump through hoops in order to get a sandwich.
So there's certainly no means testing or any of that stuff. People don't need to come and, you know, demonstrate that they can't afford food on their own or anything. I mean, your mantra is to get the food out to folks who are hungry.
Yeah, I think people who have been oppressed for centuries in this country, this might sound silly to some people, but I think they should eat for free. And I think they should eat well for free. Given what people have gone through and continue to go through in this country, I think people should at least be able to expect that they can have a meal on their table whenever they want. And that we send people through so much to get food, it tells me something. It's one of the pillars that you keep food away from people. It's one of the pillars that keeps racism in place. You starve people out, then they're not going to be able to think the big and lofty thoughts that they could think if they weren't hungry. So I think this culture actually uses food as a weapon against oppressed people. And I think there's 3 pillars that I can tell. One is hunger. One is a lack of education. And one is a lack of viable housing that they can count on. Those 3 things, you take care of those 3 things. Even if racism continues to exist after that, people will have a much better life. So I'm going after one of the pillars. One of them I'm going after, and that's the food one. And we're getting better and better at going after that food pillar.
And another aspect of this, which is impressive to me, is that you make it purposely part of your mission to give people a lot of food. I mean, a 20-pound box of food. You're not feeding folks for, you know, tonight and tomorrow. You're giving them enough food to last for a week or so they don't have to keep coming back. They don't have to get online at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a chilly day waiting for a 4 o'clock food giveaway. I mean, that's really crucial, isn't it? Isn't that a big part of what you're doing?
It's a major part. And when we do the curbs, I like the one I do in Greenmount. It's at the corner of Greenmount and East Lafayette. That one, it's different than the one that I do on the site because we give them boxes at the site and we give them some extra stuff. You know, we can maybe give them rice, canned beans, that kind of stuff. At the curbsides that are away from my location, I take I take garbage bags with me. So people walk away, Tom, looking like Santa Claus. I'm not kidding. They have a bag on their right shoulder and a bag on their left shoulder, and they're carrying these heavy bags. I give them so much food that I want them to go home and store some of the food. You know, a lot of people in this city are living meal to meal. They're not sure where the next meal is going to come from, a lot of people. So I give them enough food so they don't have to worry for a while about where the next meal is coming from. So that's what I think is that with throwing away so much food, I just want to access that 70 to 60% that we don't throw away. I don't care. Everybody keep that. If I can go after that 30 to 40%, I will feed Baltimore really, really well. And that's what we do. We go after that 30 to 40% and we feed them well.
Yeah. And it's incredible that this is food that would end up in a dumpster if you weren't literally rescuing it and giving it to people who are greatly in need. I do want to ask you about the meat. We sort of glossed over that. You mentioned that in addition to the boxes of food, you're giving them fresh meat and high quality meats. These are meats that you're getting from Amazon and places, you know, this is stuff that you would see on the shelves at Whole Foods, right?
Absolutely. So the meat that we give them, it's really been fascinating to me, this food rescue thing. So the meat that we're giving them, Tom, is the dates on it, the expiration date, it's greater than, like, so let's say you go to Safeway and 3 days from now, the chicken that you just purchased, has an expiration date 3 days from now. Some of the meat that we're getting, it doesn't expire for 10 days, 2 weeks. Like, it's really good meat. So when some of the meat that we give to them is better than the meat that they would buy if they went to the grocery store. So in every week that it changes, because we don't know what we're going to rescue this week, but we get chicken, shrimp, just like beef, steaks. We get like so much good stuff that I've never had anybody complain about what they get from us, because it's just really good food.
Just terrific work. J.C. Falk, the founder of Be More Community Food. J.C., thank you so much for your time today and for all the work that you're doing day in and day out. Good luck and Godspeed.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Coming up, we're going to meet Dr. Maricela Gomez. She's one of the co-founders of Volar, the Village of Love and Resistance. That's an organization that is promoting a new model for economic development on Baltimore's East Side. But before we take a quick break, a word about incredibly sad news for our city. Dante Barksdale, the outreach coordinator for Safe Streets, was shot to death near the Douglas Homes in East Baltimore yesterday. I do not know the circumstances that led to Dante's murder. I do know that as a violence interrupter, Dante dedicated the last 10 years of his life to de-escalating disputes and intervening in situations where he convinced people who were considering violence to consider an alternative. He repeatedly placed himself in dangerous situations using his skill, intelligence, and compassion to show people a better way, a safer way, a way forward. He was trying to make Baltimore better. He refused to give up on young people who had, in some instances, given up on themselves. Dante knew the pressures and stresses that people in communities of color experience and how those challenges can sometimes lead to bad decision-making. He knew about this because of his own life experience and because of his empathy and his love. Who knows how many lives he saved? His loss is profoundly sad. His presence and leadership will be sorely missed. His murder is a horrible reminder of the challenges we face as a city. I last spoke with Dante here on Midday in August. A link to that conversation is on our website. Dante Barksdale was 46 years old. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on mental health. As the Trump administration ends its chaotic and divisive term in office, with the nation's capital and capitals around the country on high alert for more violence, Dr. George Everly of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health talks about the psychology of terrorism and how psychological first aid can help all of us reduce our anxiety and fear about what we're confronting in the headlines and in our daily lives. Dr. George Everly will join me tomorrow on Midday, plus Senator Jim Rosapep will reflect on the life and legacy of former Senate President Mike Miller, who died of cancer last Friday. If you've just joined us today on this MLK holiday and day of service, we are meeting people who are working to advance and empower people in their communities. My next guest is Dr. Maricela Gomez, a physician, public health expert, and author who is the co-founder of Volar, the Village of Love and Resistance in East Baltimore, which is advancing a new vision for economic development. Dr. Gomez joins us on Zoom. Dr. Gomez, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me on behalf of Volar.
So you have just purchased, Volar has just purchased a couple of buildings that were a former church and a rectory on Monument Street in the East Side. What are you going to use? How's that building going to be renovated, and who's going to be in there once it's finished?
Right. So before I answer that, I wanted to just share who Valar is, Village of Love and Resistance, as you mentioned. And our mission is to co-create a cooperative community in East Baltimore, as you mentioned. Specific to us, we're owned by Black and Brown folks. We feel it's important for Black and Brown people to own stuff. And we're doing this through a cooperative model to reclaim land. We're looking at healing and help because this is also a very fractured communities that we're working with, and reconnecting folks through building a base of power where we are organizing folks to take back land. And the first piece of land is the church you mentioned, the Rectory and Monument and Ensor Street. It's about 17,000 square feet, and we bought it free of debt, meaning we own it with cash, thanks to the generous donation from different donors. And this property will become one part will be a collective housing unit, and the other part, about 13,000 square feet, will be a community hub, we're calling at the time. At this time, it'll have an event space for community to use. It'll have healing space for alternative healing, such as community acupuncture, mindfulness, meditation practices, massage. We'll have some pop-up retail. We'll have a child care center. We did some outreach in the neighboring communities to ask what people wanted to see in the building, and the priority out of 34 ideas was community child care, and so we'll have that. And then we'll have space to rent and have the opportunity for folks to co-own other social justice organizations to be there to co-own space. And of course, Valar will have its space there. And the alternative economic model that we're doing, as you mentioned, is the Community Investment Trust Fund. So what we're doing and in the process of developing is a education curriculum that will help people understand about investment opportunity. When they're finished with that training, which will be about 8 or 9 hours, over probably a period of 2 to 3 days, people will be able to take that certificate and invest in that building for as little as $10 a month, $10, $20, $30 a month. This will be aimed at people within the 4 zip codes around the building. And in this way, $10 might not seem like a lot, but $10 begins to build land ownership. Begins to help people know that they're part of developing, they're part of deciding what happens in that building, because with co-owning comes co-decision-making and co-leadership. And we're hoping that this model will really not only be a way for people to understand this whole other world of investment, something that has been accessible primarily to white America, right? White supremacy has really disenfranchised Black folks, and particularly low-income Black people. In fact, white supremacy has built low-income Black communities. And so talking about investment, inviting in opportunities for low-income Black people, the very people that were exploited in order for white wealth to have the kind of wealth it has, right? 10% of wealth, Black people have 10% of white wealth compared to white people, right? 60% of the income of white people. That's the income equivalent for Black people. And so white supremacy has really exploited extracted from Black people, off the back of Black people, as Dr. King said, right? The suffering of the poor enriches the rich. And so what Valar is about is really turning that on its head, something that has been wrong, to turn it upside down and make it right. That is, how do we invite in the very people that were extracted from to build white wealth? How do we invite in that very group of people to become now participants in that system that have exploited them? How do we do that with love and understanding and healing?
Dr. Maricela Gomez is a co-founder of Valar, the Village of Love and Resistance. If you'd like to pose a question to Dr. Gomez, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. To email us, it's midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at Midday WYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at Tom Hall. WIPR. So the small dollar investors, the folks who live in, as you said, the zip codes that are, you know, adjacent to the community center. Why is it so important for people to be able to invest as little as $10 or $20 a month and have ownership not only of this building, but I guess down the road, you're looking for people to be able to get ownership and reclaim ownership of housing in the area and other physical, you know, real estate. Why is real estate so central to your mission?
Because real estate has been central to white wealth building, right? Real estate has been central to the way that we have come to live in this legacy that Dr. King talked about, this legacy of exploiting the poor, exploiting Black people, and using war and militarism to exploit that same population. So real estate builds wealth, right? It's been the land owning people who, the railroad folks who owned the railroads back in the day, who took the land from the native indigenous people, right? That was a land accumulation process, who took exploited land. So that's what real estate is, and it's a nice term, but really it's about who gets to take the land, and that who gets to take the land is built into the policy and the imbalance. Who gets to be an investor? Some states you have to have $500,000 in the bank, free and clear, in order to become an investor. One of the models we're basing our model on is San Diego. When they started doing this, to have their residents in a low-income neighborhood co-own a plaza, they had to change the legislation so low-income people could become an investor. That's how rigid real estate and investment has made sure certain people have access and certain people don't. So real estate, especially accumulation of land, is so critical in starting to minimize this divide, this fragmentation between who has and who does not. In Baltimore particularly, we have such a history of uneven development, redlining, urban renewal, gentrification. East Baltimore in particular, with Johns Hopkins institutions, is two blocks down from where our hub is. They have such a history of land exploitation. Just in the 2,750 Black families were displaced for the biotech park at Johns Hopkins. So we have this history that we need to change. And that's what Valar is about. Valar is saying there is a different way to do real estate development. There is a different way to do any kind of development. It can be done in a way where everybody participates. And hey, here's a way. Beedy, the next time who's involved in the PSO, the Perkins Somerset Old Time Development, the next time you decide to do development, why don't you think about 50% of that development is open to community being able to invest as little as $10 or $20 and become co-owners of that development instead of having to sit by and watch their community get redeveloped by speculators and outsiders who eventually price them out of housing, price them out of amenities so that they have to move along and the whole community is now inhabited by different people. And we call that making a community better. Now, all we've done is change the bricks and mortar and charge prices that doesn't allow the legacy or the historic resident to participate. Then that group has to leave or they're displaced. And now the place supposedly is renovated or revitalized. And I ask you, go into these communities anywhere in the country and look and see how many of them were there through the grime, through the crime. Most of them are not, because they're displaced. So what Valar is doing is bringing in an alternative vision. The model we're using, it's been done in San Diego, most recently in Portland, Oregon. They did the same thing, bought a plaza, did education, invited in residents to co-own the property and be deciders of what happened in those properties. And it changes. Yeah. People change when they have ownership. They get to decide what happens in their community.
And one of the other aspects of this community investment trust fund model is that the small investors and the large investors, because you do have some large, what you're looking for is folks who are interested in social impact investing, but the rate of return for the large investors and the small investors is going to be different. How does that work?
Right. So that's a significant part, and thanks for bringing that into the space. Our low dollar investors will receive the highest return on their investment. So the models we're working with, their communities have been receiving 8 to 10% annually on their investment. The larger dollar investors, what we're calling the social impact investors, who don't live in the community, but also will need to will receive something much lower. So the investment firm we're working with, we're looking at 0 to 1.5% on their investment. And so we're just changing the game. The higher dollar investor receives a low return, and the lower dollar investor receives the high return. We talk about redistributing wealth, right? Everyone and their brother has something about changing the game and making Black Lives Matter. Well, we're going to invite in people who really want to step into that game with their feet and not just their mouth. So if you really want to redistribute that wealth, then you should be ready to receive a lower return, because you know that that will allow a lower income person to receive a higher return. So it really builds into this understanding that we're connected, right? My wealth is connected to your wealth. My wealth, wealthy person, can be and will be connected to your wealth, low-income person, if I actually allow my wealth to be redistributed. And am I willing to receive a lower return on my investment to do that? So we're inviting in change in this way, deep-rooted change that can really model what can be done, not just in East Baltimore, but across the city and beyond.
This model, as you say, is not brand new. It's been tried in other places, particularly on the West Coast. It really is. It's a matter of political economic will, isn't it? I mean, to look at the possibilities for development differently than have been looked at heretofore.
Right. And so that's the will, right? If you have the will, there's a way, right? Intention is the first part in making something happen. So this is not rocket science, people. This is really not rocket science. What it is a heart science. It's a science that says, I'm ready and willing to change the way we've been doing things. We keep doing the same thing over and over, and we expect different outcomes. Well, no, this is a different way. If you have the will to see change happen, if you have the will to live into Dr. King's vision and life, as we're celebrating in service here, right? Then you need to be ready to put that will into action. Most of our political leaders, I mean, there is change going on, don't have the will to really talk about how do we address Black poverty? How do we address this history of low income fragmentation, the help that's so desperate in low income communities versus white communities, the lack of affordable housing, the lack of food, as JC was just speaking about. How do we do that? Well, we have to be willing, right? We have to be willing. But if we don't have that will and we're not ready to make some sacrifices, so that person, that the developer that's used to getting a two-digit profit margin because of that subsidy from the government in tax increment financing, if they didn't get that subsidy, they would get a one-digit profit. They will still make money, right? So that subsidy from the government allows them a two-digit profit. What we're saying is, are we willing to start to redistribute, rethink? Are we willing to do this? Is the government willing and ready to subsidize organizations like Volar that are willing and ready to do it differently so that we actually have a different outcome? Are we ready to step away from our mouths, our rhetoric, you know, the blah, 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 and to step into something more meaningful and that's actually going to change the way that we live together?
Dr. Maricela Gomez is a co-founder of Volar, the Village of Love and Resistance, and she's also the author of a book called Race, Class, Power, and Organizing in East Baltimore, Rebuilding Abandoned Communities in America. Dr. Gomez, good luck and Godspeed. Thanks for the work that you're doing and for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, a Catholic bishop whose ministry has long been grounded in organizing and activism. Bishop Bruce Lewandowski joins me on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. On this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday and day of service, we are meeting a few folks who make every day a day of service. My next guest is Bishop Bruce Lewandowski, who also joins us on Zoom. He's the pastor of the Sacred Heart of Jesus Church in Highlandtown and active in BUILD, Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development. His ministry at Sacred Heart, like his previous ministries in New York, the Caribbean, and Philadelphia, is very much premised in community organizing and activism. His parish includes a Latinx community that has been particularly hard hit by the coronavirus and for whom traditional sources of relief are largely inaccessible. Bishop Bruce, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Very happy to be with you, Tom. Thanks for the invitation.
So the statewide positivity rate for coronavirus as of today is 8.22%. Generally speaking, what is the positivity rate for the folks in your parish?
We generally find ourselves around 30, between 28 and 30 for positivity. Our best days, which were a couple months ago, we found ourselves around 18. That's the lowest we've ever been during this time of COVID. So we live in an area, in an atmosphere where COVID is very present and prevalent, like everyone else, but it seems to be more intensified here in the zip code 21224 where we live.
And what, in your estimation, are the biggest problems that the folks in your parish are confronting?
Well, one of the problems, I think, and I just want to say, Tom, I felt the weight and sadness in your words as you gave your tribute to Dante Barksdale. One of the issues is violence. I just want to say before I go on with this, Dante's light still shines in Baltimore, even though he's gone. You know, there are some people who bring a light so great to the world that you could say that even after they've gone, that light still remains. And I think for the 10 years of light that Dante radiated in Baltimore, we know that his light is still going to shine, will continue to shine in safer streets.
You're right, Bishop Bruce. You're right.
Violence is part of everyday reality. People, you know, we're talking about food. Food and the need for food and good nutritious food is an everyday struggle. Dealing with unemployment, dealing with evictions, difficulties during time of COVID to connect children to school, fears about immigration, the immigration process during COVID and how that will play out, and fear and anxiety about a new administration coming in very few days. The stress and tension levels in the Latino community are really high. Our Hispanic community faces what a lot of people face daily, but I think it's intensified somewhat, especially if you don't have status or documents.
Yeah, and without documents, you don't qualify for a lot of government assistance. So how are you? I mean, these are folks who are working in many instances. They have employment identification numbers, but they don't have traditional social security numbers. They are paying taxes, but they cannot take advantage of many of the government programs, you know, the PPP and that sort of stuff, and with their businesses, et cetera. What is it? How are you attacking those problems sort of one at a time? Let's start with food. Making sure a lot of families in your parish, through your coordination with your folks at BUILD, are getting food into their households. How are you accomplishing that?
That story starts 2 years ago, Tom. Our parish started organizing. We sent ourselves on mission, taking Pope Francis's invitation to be missionary disciples. We took that seriously, and we claimed our mission territory here in the city of Baltimore. We have a parish here of about 3,500 families, but our participation extends beyond those families to about 10,000 Latinos living in our area of 21224 and 21222. When I got here as the pastor, I realized I didn't know everybody, was trying to meet people. And so what we did is we organized ourselves for a 2 month period to go door to door. We claimed our mission territory. We sent out 150 missionaries, parish leaders, who went door to door in the territory, the area between Orleans and Boston Street 95 and North Central. We went door to door. We knocked on probably about 3,000 doors and met our neighbors. We asked, how are you? Who are you? We'd like to know you. We all live in the same area. We're all living with the same experience, the same difficulties and struggles, the same joys of living in Baltimore's Highlands and other neighborhoods. What we didn't know is when we did that door-to-door work, we were setting ourselves up with a perfect strategy for food distribution during a time of COVID. So what we ended up doing was going back to the same people that we had met in our door-to-door work and asking, what do you need? And with Build and the help and support of some very generous and helpful people, and now with the help of the city of Baltimore, Mayor Scott has made sure that there's a food bridge between the government food that ended in December, and we're headed now with this food bridge till March, till the new administration lets us know what will happen with food distribution from the USDA and other agencies. So we went to people at their door. We said, what do you need? People needed food. So with Build, weekly, we take 1,000 boxes of food to people's doors. We have 18 drivers. The food is dropped here in our church parking lot. The drivers take it to people's homes. So the people don't come here to get the food. The food is delivered. That's for a number of reasons. Some of the families are COVID positive and in quarantine. Some of the families don't have transportation. It would be hard for them to carry boxes around. Some of our families all the struggles during the time of COVID, finding things difficult. So they take the food. And this strategy has really opened up for us the opportunity to deepen relationships with people. There's a phrase in Spanish, gente puente, bridge people. And so our drivers, our 18 drivers, our 20 drivers weekly are bridge people. They're not just delivering a box of food at the door to people who are in their homes. They ask questions. Are the lights on? Does the water run? Is your kid connected to school? Do you have any unemployment benefit? Do you have any sick leave? Are you getting paid? Do you need financial support? So the meeting at the door, it's brief. It's a box of food passed from one person to another that can feed up to four people, a family of four. Some houses get two or three boxes, depending on the number of people there. But it's also a conversation that says, we care about you, we're concerned about you, we want to help you. Let us know what you need, and let's work on getting that for you together.
Bishop Bruce Lewandowski is the pastor of the Sacred Heart of Jesus Church in Highlandtown. On this MLK Day of Service, we're talking about folks for whom a mission of service is something that happens every single day. And Bishop, let me ask you about another program you've been involved in advocating for, and this is called the Pay to Stay program, the Pay to Stay Home program. Why is that important for the folks you're helping out?
It's important for people who don't have unemployment benefits or sick leave. So when someone tests positive for COVID, they're asked to quarantine for 10 to 14 days. That quarantine means that you can't go to work. A missed paycheck means not paying your rent, not paying lights, not buying things for your children for school, whatever they might need, not paying for food. So the pay to stay, first of all, is to supplement, to take the place of whatever unemployment or sick leave pay an individual would receive from their employer or from the government. A lot of our folks don't have those benefits because they work with a tax ID number. They don't have a social security number. They work in jobs that don't provide benefits necessarily. The other part of that strategy is we don't want people to move around. Pay to stay means stay home. You'll be taken care of. You'll have what you need. And you need to stay home to prevent the spread. It's a mitigation strategy. So in our Latino community that has been particularly disproportionately hit hard by COVID, we want people who are COVID positive to stay home and not to go to work. If you don't have unemployment benefits or any sick leave, you're going to go to work because you need the money. Whether you have COVID or not, you're going to go out to make that paycheck because you want to pay rent and not be evicted. You want to put food on the table. You want to make sure your family has what it needs. So the $600 to $800 per family that is received helps people just stay at home, get well, and not worry about whatever financial problems they might be facing.
And as you mentioned, so many of the folks that you're helping out, you know, they didn't get stimulus checks the last time. They're not on the list to get it this time.
That's right.
It's often the case that the immigrant community is ignored by the federal, state, and even the city government. But when that happens, and how do you answer the folks who say in our last couple of minutes here, how do you answer the folks who say, well, look, they're not Americans. You know, America doesn't owe them assistance and help because they're not Americans.
Well, I would say I want to introduce you to 15 ladies who do laundry for hospitals. So I consider them frontline workers. They have their tax ID numbers, may not have social security numbers, but they're washing the linens from the hospitals where people are recuperating from COVID and eventually, and unfortunately, some folks are dying from COVID. I would say folks like that, they're truly American. You know, they're putting themselves at risk in a very risky environment, doing laundry from hospitals where COVID patients are being cared for. I don't think there's anything more American than taking a job like that, working hard to help lift up your family and move your family forward. I would say the city of Baltimore has done well under Jack Young and now Mayor Scott in making sure that money got into the hands of people in our vulnerable community, hands of people that need it through different strategies and different programs, especially through MEMA and Catalina Rodriguez. A good shout out to Catalina Rodriguez for her great work at MEMA and making sure that resources are available to our immigrant communities, especially the Hispanic community. But there's so much more that we could do. I would love to see that the state of Maryland with the stimulus and all of the benefits that have come through the $1 billion promise now in COVID aid, if that could take care of our tax paying immigrant brothers and sisters, that would be a great help, a great lift for people who are really down and out during a very difficult time.
Bishop Bruce Lewandowski is the pastor of the Sacred Heart of Jesus Church in Highlandtown. Bishop Bruce, God bless, Godspeed. Thank you for your work and for your time today. We'll stay in touch. Appreciate it.
Good being with you. God bless you too. Take care.
We will have links to more information about all of the folks that we've talked to today on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day of Service edition of Midday. Come to the Midday webpage at WIPR.org. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, the psychology of terrorism. Dr. George Everly of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health will join me. Plus, Senator Jim Rosapep will reflect on the life and legacy of Senator Mike Miller. He passed away from cancer on Friday. Coming up now, it's Here and Now. And later today, be sure to download the Daily Dose for all of the latest news about Maryland's response to the coronavirus pandemic. I'm Tom Hall. Happy holiday. Thanks for listening. Let's talk again tomorrow.
You're tuned to 88.1 WYPR.